What are we doing here?
You were pretty done in the evening, too.
Oh, this is a conf grenade.
It is.
Oh.
Mine conf grenade.
Oh, actually.
It's March 6th, 2012.
This is the Idle Thumbs conf grenade for GDC 2012, the first one. I'm Chris Remo.
And I'm Sean Vanneman.
I'm Steve Gannon.
I'm Jake Rodkin.
And I'm Nick Brecken.
Oh. Whoa! Whoa! Surprise!
There are too many of us in this room.
Yeah, there really are. I'm sorry we all had to come into your hotel room, Nick.
That's okay.
I apologize.
I don't.
I. Oh!
Yeah.
All right.
Welcome back, Nick.
Thanks.
Forever.
Fuck you!
Whoa!
Off to a good start. So how'd you guys all like the Game Developers Conference that you all attended today?
We developed a game.
Yeah, I participated in the G&D of Game Developers Conference
between 3:30 and 4 o'clock.
That's
with
true.
Mark and Dennis.
I developed a game today. I conferred for a half hour in a meeting room. I did not attend the Game Developers Conference. Mm.
But you achieved, you know, in the spirit of things. You probably were conferring about video games
Steve, I developed way more games than anyone developed at Game Developers Conference.
Yeah.
Except for those people who made a game today, probably. At some session or not.
There was probably a jam going on, let's assume. Yeah. I've been enjoying it. if the people who actually went to it should be involved with this discussion of it.
What did you enjoy?
Well, I've been going to the Indie Game Summit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's cool. Like, it's just a single-track thing, so, you know, it's not... My normal GDC experience is like, oh, I have to pick between all the 20 things that are going on, but the Indie Game Summit is just like, talk by this guy.
Is this your first year doing a summit thing?
I did the game design workshop 1 year, but I haven't gone to one of these things before. It's been really interesting, because you went to a bunch of the same talks I did, Chris.
I did, yeah. I probably went to about half the ones you went to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were there any that stood out to you?
I like Brendan's.
Yeah. you're biased.
I might be biased. Our buddy Brendan Chung, Gravity Bun, and obviously 30 Flights of Loving, gave a talk today about the development of Atom Zombie Smasher, which one of the things I thought was really interesting about it, actually, is that he talked about how Atom Zombie Smasher was a prototype that he started developing actually before he made Flotilla or Air Forte or, you know, his other commercial games. That he made and was just wasn't really able to complete in a way that he wanted to. So he made these other two games, and then years later came back to Atom Zombie Smasher, which came out last year. And like as far as I can tell, it's been his most successful game. I mean,
it's a finalist in the IGF.
Were the things that were holding him up technical proficiencies, or just sort of like financial, or
there was a combination of technical and design elements. It seems like where first of all, as just a self-taught programmer, there were a lot of inefficiencies in the way he was coding his game, and you know, the framework he was using to build it, which ended up becoming sort of refining itself over the course of several games. He's basically just building on this code base he has from game to game, to the point where now he says it's a fairly refined and robust.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, I guess a little bit. It's interesting to think of Flotilla and Atom Zombie Smasher being built on the same technical debt.
Because one of them's 3D, one of them's 2D.
Yeah, they don't seem on the surface to have a whole lot in common.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's cool because it seems like he had this idea of Atom Zombie Smasher when he was relatively new to doing, like, he had done a bunch of mod stuff before that, but like actually
he made Gravity Bone before that.
Yeah, but actually like building the tech from the ground up and basically it seemed, I mean, he had a whole slide about it, so he acknowledges this. His Atom Zombie Smasher was kind of his first failure, you know, like he just didn't architect it right, and then he learned how to do it better to the point where he could come back to it, and that's cool. It sort of demonstrates how that idea was clearly legitimate in his mind, where it's, you know, it kept coming back to him over the years, even though it wasn't a success at first, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I agree. And there was some interesting stuff in there about, like, I've always compared that game to XCOM for a lot of different reasons. I mean, most obviously the distinction between the world map and the resolution of battles, you know, in the sort of tactical space.
Yeah.
And one of the things he pointed out is that, you know, he was very influenced by XCOM as well as other games. And when he was, his first take on the game, the world map had a much more complicated set of mechanics associated with it, where all the different regions had all these different numbers corresponding to the scale of the invasion and the, you know, various factors that would influence the battle and all this different shit.
And how many scientists there were in every region and how many civilians, and you can move them around and all this shit.
And it was just really overwhelming. And it took, you know, he talked about how being the entire development team, it was really hard for him to have that ability to look at his work objectively and realize what was not fun about that. You know, he just thought it was, he was like, oh, this is great. I've got all these numbers in
just
here.
Just move all these things around.
Like, And he kept giving it to people who just thought it was not fun at all.
Yeah.
And he just couldn't put those pieces together in his mind.
It, well, it kind of seemed like one of those things where, you know, he implemented it all and he's like, yeah, this is exactly what I imagined it would be like. So I'm really happy with it.
Yeah.
You know, which is really easy to do, you know, like, this is exactly what I pictured. Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes that's what always happens, actually. Yeah. Oh, I made exactly,
whoops.
Well, I enjoy it secretly, but now I like it less now that other people have told me that it's bad.
Did you go stuff?
No, Brecken? No. I just flew in.
Nick Brecken.
No. I will tomorrow, though, so I can talk about that tomorrow.
It's really compelling stuff, Brecken. Nick. All the way here, man.
Yep, I know. This is what your people wanted.
Sorry.
Well, this is the first, it's been pointed out, this is the first time since the live PAX cast that we did that all five of us have...
And only the second time ever.
Yeah. That all of us have been talking to a mic at the same time.
Well, what also it is, we so rarely get to all hang out.
It's
true,
yeah.
You know,
it's a good point.
At this stage.
It's really nice. Because we all secretly hate each other, though.
Well,
yeah.
So.
Well, all of us individually hate certain configurations of others of us. So it's okay for any, you know, certain combinations of three of us to hang out.
Right.
It's like one of those
things.
It's
like a civilization diplomacy map where there's just like, some people are like red lines and then there's just me off.
If someone goes back and listens to the entire back catalog of Vital Thumbs, they could actually chart this out and they can figure out.
They can piece together the like
dining
chart where Mr. Brown can't sit next to Mrs. Smith or whatever, except everyone just can't sit next to Nick Brecken.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and for me, the configuration I like is if all four of you guys are hanging out together and I'm just not involved.
That's the rarest configuration.
True, I guess.
Well, Nick,
yeah.
So did you find, did you pull, I mean, now that you're, I don't know, in the, like, raise your right hand if you want me to talk about this on the cast, but did you find, now that you're off doing your own thing and sort of like starting to put the pieces into place to build whatever you're going to build, did you find today to be like inspiring in any certain way, or did you take from it something that like you're like, oh man, that's, I'm really glad I'm here listening to this right now while I'm at the precipice of what I'm about to do?
I thought it was cool. I thought it was interesting. You know, like, I mean, I left, you know, full-time employment in December, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I've been doing contracting stuff and whatnot, but yeah, I'm kind of at the very beginning of the path towards independent game development, you know? And I've kind of become more and more interested in the indie scene over the, you know, like, in recent years, because I don't know. It's been pretty dull.
I mean, nothing cool has come out. It hasn't been at all revolutionary.
Well, it's one of those things where it's hard to have the perspective to know whether I've been getting more interested because just more cool shit's been going on, or because my, you know, internal thinking has been changing. I think it's a little of both, you know, where it's like really the scene has had even just more and more cool stuff coming out of it. There were some really good talks that I thought were useful to keep in mind. Like, one of the talks that was actually really good was the guy who made that game, Sissy's Magical Pony Corn.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
And he did a short talk.
It's Untold Ent.
Untold Ent.
Untold Ent.
Yeah. I just know him.
The Untold Ent.
At Untold
Ent. Untold Ent.
Yeah, it's true. And then right after that was a talk about making trailers for your game. And they both were focused kind of a lot on promotion. You know, like, trailer obviously is explicitly promotion. But then the Ponycorn guy, a lot of his story was just about, like, I wanted to make this game with my daughter because I thought that would be really cool. But what was really important was, like, getting the word out to people and making something that people would be interested in and fostering that. And here's how I, you know, achieved that. And it was just...
That's so funny because that game feels... The way that game sort of popped up in my brain or on my computer was... It felt almost by accident. That it was like,
yeah, and
it almost felt like that a discovered yeah. thing as opposed to a promoted
thing. Yeah, that's what was interesting about it was like he was going to this game jam, you know, and he was like, man, I'm going to be gone to this game jam for like a 4-day weekend and not be around my family. That kind of sucks. I should bring my daughter with me and we'll like make a game together. And so he did that. And he said, you know, he just made the thing. And he said a journalist came up to him and was like, you know, the headline 5-year-old girl makes video game is the kind of headline that a journalist would like die for. And he was like, huh. And so when he posted like a blog post announcing it, he used the headline 5-year-old girl makes video game. and it like went viral, you know? And so it was the kind of thing where he made it for specific reasons that were personal to him and his family. But then he wanted people to actually play it. And so he did try to kind of present it in a way that would catch people's attention and make them actually examine it for long enough to become interested in it and pass it on. And
I love that. I loved playing that game. I loved it.
It was adorable. Such a good
time. Did you beat it?
I did.
Oh, man.
I beat it.
Yeah.
I finished it. I put all the pony cores in the jars.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're given such a clear goal. And
find
every
all
time
the pony
you do,
corns.
Every time, step one.
Check.
But because of, I mean, how like the goal is ridiculous and the limitations on, you know, you go make this game at a game jam, you just end up being forced to do a lot of things right, which is like feedback fast, move quickly. Like you're always sort of like gathering something, even if it's a joke.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something that makes like.
Well, you can't sit back and overthink things.
And those
you
plot
know.
Twists. What? There was that one.
When the orange guy had a pony corn under him?
Yeah.
Surprise.
Oh, man.
Didn't see that coming.
So they get you.
Spoilers, though. Sorry for those of you who haven't played the Pony Corn Adventure.
That game does a lot of things right. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So it is really cool just being in the environment with all the dudes that are just making shit happen, you know? So I'm glad I got to be here for it. For many reasons, you know, GDC is just kind of cool to come with and hang out, but great. Also, you know, there's stuff that's relevant. How exciting.
How wonderful.
I know. And I'm
Nick, what capacity, are you in here? Are you here for any particular capacity or only to absorb the magic?
I just wanted a sample of what this was like so that I can go back and be sad again.
we got that Nick Brecken on the cast.
Hey, we want to share which one of the two.
No, actually, I feel really
we
sick
have to
right
tease
now.
Out
so
the
I'm really tired.
Appropriate personality.
So I'm not really bringing. And also, I didn't do anything.
Oh, it is like 2 a.m.
So yeah, I feel really terrible. But
oh really?
Oh really?
Yeah. No, it's okay though.
We can go to your room.
No, I'm enjoying this.
I just
as if it, as if as if a man on his like if I was on my deathbed, this is like what I would want to occur. Like I
wouldn't get diagnosed. Like you're not gonna barf.
This is the last supper.
I was sort of thinking. I was like, am I gonna barf? I shouldn't barf in the direction of the mic.
I want to paint a picture here to the readers. We're arranged in sort of a semicircular arc around the microphone, and Nick is in the center of it, painting this picture of, if I were on my deathbed, this is what I'd want to happen. So this is basically like the Last Supper, where we're sort of supplicating ourselves to Nick Brecken as he dies, I guess.
Yeah,
the death of Nick Brecken, it might occur.
Episode title.
Yeah.
the last supper of Nick Brecken.
Life and Times.
The last supper of Jack in the Box. We all ate horrible food.
Did you eat Jack in the Box?
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't even get that. I didn't even get that.
I'm just trying to die.
You all ate around me. And I
ate sushi from a former Jack in the Box.
Yeah.
That's true. Everybody ate from a Jack in the Box.
Terrifying.
Once in future, Jack in the Box.
That's a good podcast.
It's pretty good.
It sold sushi for about
you know, I
a
thought
year
it was
there.
Gonna go one way. I thought there's some times on the thus far where I was like, oh man, we're pointing in the right direction, and then nope.
You don't have a thumbs happen.
Yeah.
I'm playing Grim Fandango for the first time.
Me too.
Ever.
Oh, the first time?
Ever. Yeah.
Really?
Swear to God.
How did that happen?
Yeah, I'm surprised.
I'll tell you how it happened. Is Grim Fandango came out, and I played the PC Gamer demo disc of it, but I had a 486 at the time or something.
You didn't have a graphics accelerator.
Because
I had that when that game came out, I couldn't play it because that was the first game I ever owned that actually required a graphics accelerator
right.
card.
And it doesn't require one. It has a software renderer. It just runs really bad.
Oh, then it yeah. didn't run on my computer.
Right, yeah, so I couldn't play it, and then...
Like, it wouldn't even install on mine.
I don't think I got a new computer until I got, like, a Pentium 2, and then by that time, you know, I didn't have any money, so I never played it. And it just sat
there. How far
there.
Into it,
Oh, not very far. Mercedes just showed up, and they locked me in that room, so I'm going to get out of there probably. But yeah, it was funny. It's a game where I played it. I started to play it in the evening, and it's hard. You know, it's also like everybody has an opinion about that game, and everybody's told you how good that game is.
Yeah.
So you don't really have a lot of room to start kind of craft your own space with it. But you have, at least I have to. So I just like shut myself in a room or living room. I get like 5 minutes in, and I start like tap 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 down the hallway, and he's like, "I know, sorry, Jake's like." I think I heard the Grim Fandango music on the other side of the house. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I didn't have to kick you out of the room, but I was about to. Like, did you go in the alley? Like, shut up! Shut up! So you can't play in a LucasArts adventure game around Jake. But, you know, I
what
mean,
they say.
Yeah. It's funny. It's been a long time since I played an adventure game of the LucasArts era, believe it or not. I guess... We, like, all, like, group played Full Throttle once, but it was just, like, we might as well just been watching Full Throttle the movie.
Yeah,
because we
just
click, next thing.
Blast through that.
Whereas in this, like, I did get really frustrated,
yeah,
but then
ask.
The moment I solved one thing, I remembered why I liked adventure games and went, like, oh, yes.
That's the classic arc,
yeah,
like, the parabola
know,
of
just,
playing
and
it.
And I mean,
sine wave.
Fuck. Yeah. This is the best.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's a feedback mechanism that you're so... Like, you haven't experienced in so long that you forget what exactly is pleasurable about it.
Mm.
Well, but the moment it goes into cutscene mode, you're like, I'm being given my treat.
Well, Grim Fandango is particularly, I think, a strong example of that. Like, especially more so than a game like Full Throttle. Those are both Tim Schafer's main games as project lead. And because Grim Fandango has, it's got that kind of sine wave of the, you know, valley of frustration and then the peak of that
reward.
Something
the most extreme
feedback.
Adventure game that
except,
I've ever played.
Right, except that on top of that, in Grim Fandango, just the structure of that game means it on top of the little
there's
peaks and valleys,
there's
huge rolling
breaks,
ones that all the little peaks and valleys exist on because of the act structures in that game. Which themselves
is basically
like,
just four Full Throttles back-to-back.
Exactly,
examples.
Yeah. And each one of those act breaks is like this incredible just tsunami of a rush when you get a new one of those.
Yeah.
It's just
because you're unlocking like a whole world,
yeah,
essentially.
Exactly.
Like, I mean,
and well, in all of those cutscenes,
you don't know what this is yet, Sean.
And yeah. All of the scenes
spoilers.
When that happens are just magnificent.
Yeah.
Like the first one especially is just one of my all-time favorite
Coincidentally, I'm replaying it as well, and I just hit that break, and it was just like, what? So, this is like...
Well, residual VM happened to us, I think.
Yeah.
That plus the Double Fine Kickstarter making everyone talk about Grim Fandango a bunch. There's probably a lot of people playing Psychonauts in Grim right now.
Yeah. I may have talked about this on the podcast before. I don't know.
Psychonauts.
It's fine. My original experience playing Grim Fandango was a particularly... I don't know, deep experience of that whole arc thing in my brain because when I played that game, I didn't have the internet in my house. And so I didn't have any way, I didn't have a hintbook or anything. And every puzzle I had to solve by just working through it. And that game took me actually a full year to complete. I wasn't playing it every day, but I mean, I would go through these phases where I'd really get back into it for a few days or like a week or whatever. And I'd get a bunch of stuff, and then I'd hit a wall, and I would kind of get stuck, and I would just forget about it for a week or two. And that game lasted me the better part of an entire year. And so it was sort of those little peaks and valleys and then the bigger arcs, but just writ large across an entire year of my life, which at the age I was when I played it is a significant
year.
Like when
time.
You're young, a year matters hugely
it's
in terms of
just... It's a formative novel.
Exactly. Like your personal ability to perceive the world and to draw meaningful connections between things that happen in a game and things in your life, especially because that game, there's so much melodrama in that game and there's so much really deliberately heightened emotion and so on. And so, you know, that the experience...
So many giant cats driving back.
Exactly.
Yep.
But it was that... And that's the only adventure game, though, that I've ever had that experience with. I mean, it's really long. It's the longest adventure game I've played, probably. Mm-hmm. But it's also the only one that I've actually stretched out across such a huge length of time. And inevitably, I can never have quite that same experience again, thanks to, one, the internet, and two, just being an adult now.
They also don't make games like that, especially of that length.
And so it was... Or do they?
I don't.
They don't.
Double Fine Kickstarter. Who knows? Maybe.
That game will
be huge. That game will not be Grim.
That would be a disaster if it were Grim Fandango length. But it would be a disaster? I mean, it would just be the wrong way to spend their resources to make a 40-hour adventure.
Who are you
game.
To decide what they're doing?
Fair enough.
Right. I mean, as a backer, you can contribute to the.
That's true. Don't make this Grim Fandango length.
The most pointless that comic suggestion. Shows up and you're just beaten into the ground by every other backer of that campaign.
Maybe shorter.
Shut up!
It was funny though because I played it for the first time ever Saturday night, and then Sunday I went to the office and the first person I ran into was the CTO of Telltale, Kevin Bruner, who was the gameplay programmer on that game, and it's just
that's crazy to me.
Oh, it's absolutely crazy to me because, like, I probably make games because of Full Throttle. That's the whole reason. Like, I remember just being a kid in Wyoming, just playing Full Throttle.
Full Throttle is my favorite game ever.
And I mean, that's the whole thing that put the pieces together. Went like, oh, I never knew what I'd be able to do in the game industry, but maybe there's something like this that I could do. There's something in here, maybe I could find a home.
Yeah.
But then to just literally the next person I see that isn't Jake is just. Like this wealth of knowledge about what was that experience like? Because like obviously
did you interrogate him about it?
Well, one of the first things that you said was really like those walking controls.
And he just scowled at me.
He was fine with it.
But he did say, I mean,
that's why I never replayed Grim Fandango because I tried and I'm like, holy shit!
You know what? It actually doesn't like map. Interface. It doesn't map badly to a 360 controller.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I've never tried
it. Gamepad control.
I've never tried doing that, but I should.
Is it 360 supported by residual VM on Mac?
It's not, but it's supported by the Grim Launcher, so you can you can kind of like hack that.
But not on OS X.
But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll that would be awesome. Maybe there's a way to figure it out.
Yeah,
but I mean, he's like, well, Tim really liked to play on the numpad, so the gameplay is pretty well on the numpad. You should try playing on the numpad. And we don't have a numpad on our, like, lap board, like, keyboard. But I've got a nice, like, weird lobster claw thing that I've got going that I've now just...
That specific story has way more impact on me than just, oh, yeah, and then I ran into the gameplay programmer. Like, that's the kind of weird shit when you work in the game industry that you interact with. Not just, oh, I'm working with the guy who did the programming for this game. It's like, and he said, oh, yeah... Tim Schafer really liked to play it this one way while we were developing, so you should try that.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the most supported way.
Yeah.
The way that's sort of 50% screened back in the manual and isn't on the control screen.
Right. Well, then our really good friend Chuck Jordan, who's been on he's been on Idle Thumbs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
he was also a programmer on that game, I think.
He was they were the three, there was somebody else, but those three guys definitely programmed a lot on the game and everything that's sort of CPU clock related that causes massive bugs.
Those guys also screwed that up. So that's good.
Yeah, wasn't Chuck saying that he spent an entire day timing out the credits to
match up with the music? But and then found out after it shipped that the engine was timed to your CPU clock. So that's sweet.
It's ruined his life.
Owned.
But you know, like you can't not be ridiculously grateful to realize that you've wandered into a career where that just happens to you. And you go home and say, oh, that guy's a treasure of knowledge about, you know, like you're not going to get that anywhere else.
I mean, I feel like that's probably something that happens with a lot of, like if you're in the music industry and you're a band that's recording and it's like, definitely. Oh, the guy that's running the soundboard while we're recording our album in the studio was, you know, the drummer
or whatever.
Like, what? Okay. So I'm working with a guy that, you know, made all of these albums that I grew up listening to when I was 12 or whatever. And it's, I don't know. It's interesting.
We all now have enough experience to where, like, people who were formative game industry folks, well, at least, like, you can make eye contact with them, you know?
Right.
But, like, before that, the industry is so young that it's hard to get people who are in their late 20s and early 30s and then have the next generation who have made the things that formed their opinions about the medium that they're in.
Yeah.
I feel very lucky to be part of that, I suppose. Yeah.
That was one of my first GDC experiences ever. Was I sat in on this round table. There was like a it's like a creative direction roundtable or something. I just want, and so I go in, and I just, and I'm in QA at the time, and this is like the first session I ever went to, and I just sat down in the corner, and a bunch of people come in and sit around at the table who are actually going to be like talking, and then one of them is just Will Wright, and I'm like, what? And so I'm sitting like 4 feet away from him on the floor, and the roundtable is going on, and someone else is talking. I'm just looking at Will Wright, just kind of like staring at him while he's like while he's listening to a speaker, and then he like looks over at me suddenly, and I'm just like, and like look away with shame. It was just one of those weird things where like, yeah. Oh, this is what GDC is about. Will Wright looks at you.
During my first GDC is 2004, so this year is my ninth, and that's one of the first. To me,
so. That's insane.
Yeah. One of the first experiences I remember from that GDC was, this was when it was still in San Jose, and so I was just walking down the street one night, in front of the place where they do the Game Developers Choice Awards, and I was just walking back to my hotel, and I was wearing my Corley Motors shirt from Full Throttle, it was an awesome shirt that doesn't have a LucasArts logo on it, doesn't have a game logo on it.
It's just the big motorcycle with
exactly.
All of the...
It's the CM logo.
But then on the back, it has like
the. It has a bike.
Yeah, exactly. It has a picture of the bike and the slogan "Can't beat a Corley." And I was walking down the street, and Tim Schafer just was walking the other direction of the street towards me, and I'm like, oh, in my brain, I'm like, oh man, that's Tim Schafer. And then as we like reached each other, he was like, hey, Full Throttle, I made that game. I was like, oh my god. So that I met him, and like I've known him ever since then.
So that's advice to everyone in the world: wear dorky shirts of things that you like, and then walk around where this game developers conference. You'll stand out.
That's honestly though. That's. I don't know. If you see somebody wearing
that was sarcastic,
that is,
but it's also
you will have a drink purchased by me. Yeah, absolutely.
If you're wearing a Corley Motors shirt, Sean Van.
I was coming back to Will Wright. I think we're listening to Will Wright. That was also the podcast that fostered. That was the first podcast I think it was on where the Phaedrus stuff popped up. But that Will Wright talk from GDC 2010 was probably mm-hmm. the best moment I've had at GDC, like the best thing I've ever sat in and experienced at GDC.
It's the best experience I've ever had in my life.
Recently,
I can't
think
of anything.
There's really just nothing that it would ever could top that.
Sorry,
top that.
Sorry, honey. I mean, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But
let's be honest, Phaedrus.
You should have seen this talk.
It was transcendent.
There was that Soviet space minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good talk.
Will Wright.
I was ensorcelled.
It's funny. It's a funny thing about the way people talk and converse in the video game industry, and the way people give, you know, GDC talks and addresses and things like that. There's a certain people in the games industry are incredibly smart. Like there are a ridiculous number of absurdly smart people in the games industry, and that's one of the reasons I like GDC so much. I mean, it's my favorite game-related week of the year, easily, but, you know, by a long shot. But there's a certain kind of kind of live-spoken address style or something that is not very common in games. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind that Will Wright adopts. And it's the kind you see sometimes when given by a really interesting, eclectic professor or something.
Right.
You know, like, there's a certain mm-hmm. type of intellect that is, despite how many smart people there are in the games industry, there's a certain category of intellect that is just not very common in this industry for whatever reason, but Will Wright exemplifies. And you go see a talk by Will Wright, and the breadth of topics discussed and the depth with which each one is discussed is just something on another level. I mean, it's just something
it's unbelievable.
You don't,
it might surprise you.
It might with a depth that will surprise you, yes.
Yeah. It is like, I mean, comparing it to like the most engaging university professor you've ever had or something like that. But talking about the thing that you've cared about your entire life, you know, you get like, it felt like when you're in school, you get one of those a year, and then Will Wright can just produce one of those from wherever it comes from.
He's not talking this year, is he?
I don't know.
Phaedrus is
back.
Yeah. Look for the The mysterious speaker.
Look for the most boring sounding.
The future of content.
The future of content.
Oh, that one was the Metaphysics of Game Design or something. Was his?
Oh, yeah, Metaphysics of Game Design.
Yeah,
by Fabius.
That's the reason I ended up reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
I'm actually reading it right now.
Did you like it?
I'm about halfway through.
We can talk about books now.
Sean was in love with that. You were loved that book, didn't you?
I loved it.
I do like it. I'm only halfway through it, so I can't really make a full judgment on
it. The second half is when you love it.
I also started reading it the year I started riding a motorcycle. So it's just like...
Last year?
Yeah. Oh, 2011, yeah. Yeah, I got a motorcycle.
Yes, that's last year. Confirmed.
But not that it had anything to do with it, really. It does.
No, but I mean, it gave you a little bit more of a direct connection to it. Because I have no physical experience of doing anything to a motorcycle.
Well, there's a part in the book where he talks about... Your motorcycle is going to break down on you. It is going to leave you in the rain at the worst possible time, and you're going to be sitting on a giant useless piece of metal and not know anything. And if you're going to be one of two people. You're going to be the person who says, fuck this fucking thing, fuck it, like, this thing's a useless piece of shit, I need somebody to fix it for me. Or you're going to, like, understand that it's a machine that has all these interconnected parts that at each one of them has a specific purpose, and you can fix it, and you can save yourself. Yeah. And then I was reading that part, and it was 3 a.m. and my motorcycle broke down in the middle of the city. And I was like, fuck this motherfucking thing! But I did find solace in the fact that I was in that part of the book. And then I came home, finally got home, called my fiance at the time, and said, this happened to me. And she goes, well, you're reading that book, so you should really just relax about it.
Well, did it spur you to, like, become more knowledgeable about maintaining
your absolutely, motorcycle? yeah. Every single piece of wrenching I've done probably is because of that book's ability to implicitly shame you for not doing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's cool, and it's a really interesting just thought process to point out, which is like, yeah, you can be willfully ignorant about something because it seems hard, or you can just admit, yes, this is hard and I don't know anything about it, and I'm going to take the first step.
That's sort of where he starts
to
book.
Become knowledgeable about it. So that in the future, you know, because it's like, no one's going to say that it's easy. It is complicated, and...
Well, we should do things not because they're easy, but because they're hard.
In this decade.
Is there anything else?
He starts the book defining those sort of two types of people as romantic and classic people.
But something that actually weirdly wraps back into... A talk that we saw today. You were there for the Quap talk, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Quap talk.
That was today.
I missed the Quap talk. I'm going home.
Cooperation.
Jeez.
Do you guys know?
Tell me about the Quap talk.
I will.
I have a Quap question later, but we
can. Oh, you can ask your Quap question.
Well, do you guys know if RoboQuap is actually at this show?
He didn't
mention it.
The guy after the Quap talk was that guy, Doug Wilson.
You know what RoboQuap is, though.
Yeah.
Well, the readers made
the people at home. The guy who made Johann Sebastian Joust made a hack to Quap where you strap move controllers to your legs and then those map to QWONP. So you have to, in fact, walk around to make Quap guy walk. But
in
I'm sure there's
a way that has nothing to do with actual
walking. There's no mapping in that way at all. So
walk to make Quap guy walk.
You walk. Yeah, you walk. Sentence. Walk to make Quap guy walk. Walk to make Quap guy walk. Anyway. I had heard that it might be around.
Yeah, it probably will be. I mean, they said they're going to have, like, JS Joust on the show floor, so maybe they'll do that, too.
I think multiplayer Quap is here, which I haven't done.
Well, just wait a couple days.
I loaded up multiplayer Quap the other day and tried to do it myself. It's versus Quap, and I tried to... it's two Quap guys at the same time in horizontal split screen. And I actually got a few paces doing both of them on my own. But it gets so hard because it's even twitchier than regular Quap, I assume, because it's doing more physics calculations at the same time. And the guys get out of sync even if you're hitting... Because Nick, the basic loop of playing Quap.
Yeah.
Like, well, just even eventually sort of microscopic missteps in time.
Yeah, it's chaos.
Is gonna,
Sorry, just microscopic imperfections. That's all.
In the skin.
I know. I'm laughing.
Anyway.
I'm laughing. What do you want?
I'm laughing.
I want to hear you tie what we were talking about back to Quap.
Wait, so anyway.
When you're here, we need to play co-op Quap. Or competitive Quap, I guess it is.
Competitive Quap.
I don't know.
I prefer co-op Quap.
We need to settle the score.
Oh, yeah. Quap. Yeah. From the great...
The great Quap off.
We did the Klopoff. I'm the great Klopoff.
Well, that's why I came. That was it. All right.
Yep.
And he's Nick Brecken.
Yeah. Thanks for coming, Nick.
So why are we talking about Klopoff?
Well, because he was starting
know.
To...
You know no, Steve at. Knows what we're talking about.
Bring us back. Bring us back to where
well,
we were.
So the principle that comes... That the guy, that the author of the book talks about is you can either say, that sounds hard and I'm going to ignore it, or you can say, that sounds hard and I'm going to take the first step to eventually understand it
well, like the
and
first
be
step
more
in Klopp.
Self-sufficient. And so the Klopp guy in his talk was talking about, you know, the games that he had made and stuff, but he was also talking about how he didn't put Klopp on, like, a standard Flash portal that, you know, is owned and run by somebody else and they get all the ad revenue and all that stuff. He just made his own website and he put one game on it and another until he basically had his own, you know, collection of games. Then he has to deal with all the bandwidth stuff and all the server backend and stuff. But he was arguing for why there are a lot of advantages to that because you're not giving somebody else all the profit for the games that you're making and you actually get credit as an individual. And he put up this list of basically why people don't do that. And it was all like, it's hard. I don't know how, you know, like,
and he forced himself to learn it.
Yeah. And he was basically like, yeah, it is hard. And I didn't know how either, but there are all these advantages to being self-sufficient as someone making web content. And I thought it reminded me of that at the time. So bringing it back up just was interesting.
The Indie Game Summit is super businessy, apparently.
I didn't find that to be the case.
Well, I know, just the three things you've brought up have been about that.
Have been
stuff.
More about
like how, promotions
stuff.
Sales.
Oh, yeah, but the Klopp thing doesn't, I mean,
no, I mean
that was entirely a philosophical thing, though. He didn't go into actually the logistics of any of that stuff. It was...
He did show a lot of graphs of, like, people playing different games over time and...
That's true.
Compared to...
It was a small proportion of the
Yeah,
time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there was that other talk, were you there for the guy talking about, like, being an indie developer without going insane?
That
was pretty much all business
stuff. Most quality of life stuff,
Which, I mean, that's cool,
no,
right? Because,
yeah.
I mean,
it was,
you
actually,
can go...
I like that talk.
Yeah, you can go there and you can just talk about a bunch of high-level, you know, creative stuff, or you can go to the Indie Game Summit and... talk about how to actually be successful with the game ideas that you have. And
you
I think that's pretty cool.
About it. That's really great.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And they're both really well represented. I've been impressed so far. So. Mm-hmm. And you're
two,
Nick.
Five minutes of talking about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. This makes me really happy that we're going to do a book podcast.
Yeah,
I'm so excited. Oh,
really
my gosh. I'm so excited.
Do you guys have a good name for it yet?
No.
Book podcast.
Oh, booking, caught potting.
Well, it's book podcast.
Reading.
A book,
book
podcast.
Book cool. Book gold. Terrible.
Nick Brecken.
Cool. Yeah, no, that is what it's called, though. It's called cool book. A book podcast. A podcast for readers.
We haven't even, it's so funny, we haven't even really started talking about what we're going to call it.
No.
If you guys have any ideas.
Probably book gold cast.
I want you to send me one idea a day.
It's
on
the
I
rest
am,
of your life.
I am our email. Until
I'm just
going
to use that web form that you made.
The Jeff Goldblum name generator?
Yeah, just replace one word with book.
That's fine.
Each time.
You might find something in there.
Book blast Bart Gold.
Bart.
I don't know. One of the guys on NeoGAF made a Goldblum generator, and the word Bart was added in it, which is not. That's not
that's a.
It's not canonical.
No, I don't
Bloom
know.
Term.
We're really big on canon here.
Bloom term. Mm-hmm. TM.
Yeah.
What the fuck have you
been
up to?
Yeah, I was
going to
say, Nick. What are you up? I was exactly just going to ask that. Thank you, Steve.
You guys are so on the same wavelength tonight. This is fascinating to me.
Stop being fascinated.
No, I don't.
Stop stroking your beard. Stop stroking.
I don't know. I've been at Bethesda Softworks. With the soft games making.
You heard that the more you play with them, the bigger they get?
Jesus
Christ. Is that fact or fiction?
You know what blew me away?
That is an official.
Did you know that that before Epic Games moved, when they were in Rockville, Maryland, they were called Potomac Computer Games, which blew me away when I learned this, because there is a reality where Bethesda Softworks could exist next to Potomac Computer Games, which is just like. It's really sad
early
that didn't exist.
I think Potomac. I can't even say
it. I know, it's really hard to say.
Potomac Computer Games.
It is a fantastic
name,
though.
It's
guys,
really good. We need a new name. Epic Mega Games.
I know.
Potomac Computer Games sounds too much like...
Well, that's really good. Well, because Epic Mega Games, until Nick told me that, I assumed their first name was Epic Mega Games, which you can easily imagine some like
we
late
need to move
whatever coming up with as the first thing out of nowhere. Just, oh man, I'm going to... You know, he starts making the bagged discs in his bedroom and he writes Epic Mega
Games. Potomac Computer Games.
I know.
We sound way too much like a mid... 80s computer game company. We need to sound like something
British,
of this era.
Right,
so let's call ourselves Epic Mega Games. Timeless. And then a few years later, oh man, we sound like,
I had no idea.
When did they drop the Mega Games?
Like late 90s.
3D.
No, it was...
From 2000, maybe.
Yeah, it was post...
Because the first Unreal was an Epic Mega Game, I believe.
I didn't play the first Unreal.
The Unreal Tournament games were Mega Games as well.
They were?
I think they dropped it pretty shortly before Gears. I think it was like 2004 or 5.
Maybe they faded it out of existence.
Yeah.
Because I remember...
The Mega Game slowly decreases in the logo. It's still actually there.
They're probably still registered as that.
I'm sure that somebody could look it up on fucking Wikipedia right now and we could discover
I think we should keep arguing
about it. It's clearly
based on the
tradition of names, though. Clearly the 80s was the Potomac Computer Games.
Right.
The 90s is Epic Mega Games, and they're like
2000s.
Just Epic now. 2000s. Yeah. And now they're going to be called EG or something.
Or just like a delta sign with a thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be Epic Apps.
There is a...
It'll just be E with like a winking emoticon, like a D smiley face. Ugh. What?
I saw a giant version of Infinity Blade in a photograph.
What does that mean? A giant version?
You're fucking high right now.
I was trying to bring it back to GDC. Let's just move on. Blade
in a photograph. Great.
Do you think internet?
I'd say
internet. I was fishing for
information. It's cool that you saw that giant picture in a photograph.
Of Infinity Blade.
We're going to talk about Dota?
Were your hands like...
Oh, man! Nick and Sean are in the same room now, and they can talk about Dota.
I played Dota last night with...
Did you really?
With a reader, actually.
You took Nick's advice.
A reader who aped something from the Progress Cast as his Steam handle, Throaty Timber. And Nick Herman from Telltale, a friend of Nick Herman's,
phrase.
And then a pickup guy. And I said this last night to you guys, but those guys took such good care of me. They're like, Lich, maybe you don't want to stand there, Lich. Maybe. Move back. Hey, Lich, use your chain frost.
I'm glad they referred to you as Lich.
Everybody does that.
These are people who know me as a person. Like, Lich, hey.
Hey, Demon Knight.
I noticed you have 5,000 gold. Hey. And look, it was the complete opposite of what you would expect from the Dota community.
Right.
It was babies versus Dota. It was so nice. They were we won. It was great.
They were just
we played a good team,
just such
too.
Such giving partners.
But it's like, I felt like the nicer they were to me, the more they just wanted to call me a slur.
What?
You know what I mean? I felt nicer.
The other shoe was just getting ratcheted.
So
when it finally falls, it's plummeting 80 stories.
Exactly.
That's
your
exactly
head. You'll actually
how
just
it
be
felt.
Silently banned at some point.
Yeah. Oof. And you were texting me and Steve. You were texting and calling me at the time.
and I was trying
to cook dinner. I was like, okay.
Oh,
I came home and I was like, I need to get
some bread. Hey, Lich. Maybe you want to spend a bit of that money. Phone. Pot bubbling over on the stove. Oh my
really
god.
Poor choice. Because I was at the office and then Nick Herman was there and I was like, hey Nick, I'm a little Dota a little while when I get home. Like, I'm gonna need to chill out before I go out and I want to eat some dinner and I just want to decompress before
I
go eat.
Dota's
Steve.
A total chill.
I want to decompress.
Yeah,
the most stressful game I can think of.
Yeah, and now I've got my wrist hurts. Did you say you had a
oh my god.
I had a Dota hand.
It put me out of action for like a week. Like
it really hurts. I went to the
wait, how did why?
For
it's like is it really you have to click constantly?
You have to click
something?
Constantly.
Yeah. Okay.
That's
yeah.
part of the strategy is clicking constantly so you
But not, it's not just clicking constantly.
Seriously,
though,
so your
like,
guy doesn't
like,
accidentally kill something at a turn.
Micro movements with the mouse though, because you have to move the screen with mouse, you know, to the edge of the screen. You can't really use the keyboard because you're left.
Stein has to be on hotkeys. So right. He's doing all these micro movements and then clicking like 1,000 times per minute, and it's just like it translates into just
God, this like, he says yeah, like 1,000 times per minute.
No, it's really fun, actually.
Yeah, no, it's
no, no, no. He says like 1,000 times per minute. I bet you click 1,000 times per minute.
Some people probably
I bet people are just like, yeah. It is.
I mean, I don't know. People like it. I've never played it. Uh-oh. I've never heard anything. Heard anything that sounds attractive about this game on any level. Not because I just heard, yeah, everybody's gonna call you all the worst names and say you're a piece of shit and you're gonna lose constantly. And now it's like, oh yeah, and you'll be physically deformed and mangled by it. What?
So really, it's really good.
Do you play multi games ever?
I play like co-op stuff. I mean, I've had.
Or like competitive multi.
We played a bunch of Brink when that came out.
I've had phases where I've done straight up co-op multi or just like competitive stuff. Like I was into like Gears of War 1 competitive for a while and like Counter-Strike and stuff. But it's always just a phase. Like I never stick with anything for very long.
My phase is maybe longer than yours, but it's the same way. We'll see. But I'm in deep with Dota right now.
You're just going to have a fucking bloody stump for a right hand before it's long.
I had this dream. I went to bed.
Just picturing after bursting out of your fucking skin horribly.
I had a dream that my thumb was deformed. Actually, I had a dream last night that my thumb was deformed and somebody kept throwing me a football that I couldn't catch.
Hey, Lich, catch the ball, bitch. Hey, Lich. Can't do it. I got to make pasta. Hey, Lich.
The football would hit me in the face because my thumb wouldn't open enough, and then I woke up, my wrist was really hurting. It was Dota.
In your dream, you were.
Well, I think I went to sleep and I was starting to get wrist inflammation from playing Dota. And then in my dream, my body interpreted that as your wrist. I'm going to just manifest that into a dream where a guy's throwing a football at your face and you can't catch it. And it kept hitting me in the face. And then the earthquake woke me up.
That's just like playing Dota.
In real life.
It's not like all of that. It's just getting hit in the face.
So I experienced the earthquake, which sucked. And then my wrist hurt for the rest of the day. So. Dota.
In
play
conclusion,
it.
Play it.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Have fun.
What's your hero? What do you play?
I play Lina. Yeah.
What's Lina's deal?
She has a super powerful nuke. Oh god.
Go.
Yeah, no. She's here. She's a ganker. She ganks. You have to wander around and like you know. I mean, it's basically a really easy hero to get into like initially.
What the hell happened to you, Nick? Come on, you're so sad. It's really an easy hero. It's fine.
Oh, no,
she's ganks.
She's got this nuke.
Well, I'm trying to branch out, but I always fall back on Lina because right. I want to be good, you know. But I try and diversify.
Yeah.
And you lose.
One competitive game that I do play and have spent some time playing is Street Fighter, and I'm just saying this because it reminds
it's
me
similar.
Of like
you have your one guy.
Like
and you're really
I can only
at,
play
you,
quarter circle characters, and like I have like two or three characters that I'm pretty good with, and I'll be like, I'll try. Chun-Li or something, and I'm like, oh, nope. And I just go back to the thing that I can kind of win sometimes with.
Yeah.
Well, JP, you know, we were hanging out with JP last night, and he was basically asking...
JP LeBreton, friend of the show.
JP LeBreton, right. He works at Double Fine. He was on the show before once. And
he and I used to work together, too.
Oh, yeah, of course. And he was saying, so what do I actually have to do? What steps should I take
if I
actually want to become good at StarCraft II? What should I actually do? And it's actually a really difficult question to answer. And in the case of that game in particular, I mean, I actually recommended what Nick and I did. Nick and I, for several months, actually, pretty much played that game every night together, but 2v2. So you aren't just kind of just constantly, repeatedly throwing yourself into the grinder just to get spit out again in 1v1.
Mm-hmm.
But the other, the reason I bring it up in with respect to what you guys were talking about is that when I play that game, I really have only ever played as Protoss, at least in multiplayer. In single player, it's easy. It doesn't make any difference. But in multiplayer, I've only ever played a Protoss. And so whenever I choose a different race, it's just a massacre. Like, I'm like a baby. I'm a child. Because Nick and I got to the point, what did we get up to? Like, silver? Gold?
We maxed a diamond or platinum.
Actually.
Yeah, we hit the top tier.
I remember tracking via Twitter.
Yeah.
You guys were really good.
And so, right. And so we got to the point where,
platinum.
Like, on at least a fundamental level, I understood the mechanics of that game really well, right? I mean, relative to.
Well, the other thing we were doing
was
watching professional play.
No, we were constantly watching professional play and commentary. But what I'm saying is, and in those cases, I was watching, obviously, every matchup you could think of. Turn versus Terran, Turn versus Zerg, Turn versus Protoss, blah, 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 every combination. And I would play the game. I understood how all it works. I understood what would happen when an opponent was playing Terran, and he would attack, and this and that. And yet, any time I tried to play anything other than Protoss, I mean, I might as well just have never heard of StarCraft before.
Yeah.
Like, it would have made no difference if I had any experience with StarCraft at all. That's how alien it felt. And so when someone like JP, when he says, what do I do to get good at StarCraft? I remember what it's like when I play a race that isn't Protoss, and then I'm just, oh my god, I've gotten to Platinum League, and I don't even know how I would start learning at this race. Like, what can I possibly tell this guy who's never even played StarCraft to begin with?
Right.
It's just impossible.
Yeah.
I feel like the only reason I even have I even was able to become decent in StarCraft is because I played StarCraft 1 back when I was in college. You know, when that game was more current.
I mean, it's almost like learning a language or being good at drawing or something. Whereas, like, in a lot of cases, like, all right, hey, I'm, 30.
Right.
How do I learn Italian?
Step one.
Start talking to Italian people when you were 8.
Like, yeah, exactly. Sorry.
You know? Or just be ready to kill yourself for years.
Yeah. Or pretend you're 8 now and get ready to be good at Italian in about 10 years.
Yeah. Well, opportunity. It's also something I brought up to JP. Yeah. It's a big opportunity cost issue.
You wrote an email to him about that?
No, I brought it up.
He was sitting there.
I thought you said something I wrote up to JP, and I'm like, this continues.
And this is the thing that actually has made me really self-conscious, is that around the time I started playing Dota, Jake started playing the banjo. And now Jake can play the banjo a little bit. And I hear him like in his room, and it sounds like music, and I'm just getting called a faggot by a stranger. So, you know, you have to pick wisely.
Yeah, well, because on some level, the main part of the answer to that question is spend a fuckload of time playing StarCraft.
Right,
yeah. And yeah, it's like, or Dota, or whatever. And it's like, well, you can get good at an instrument or a video game. But unless you have twice as much time, it's not going to be both.
Yeah.
There was an interesting, like, the way that you described it to him was like, take everything that matters to you in your life and put it on a table and just say, which one of these am I going to delete and replace with StarCraft? Yeah. I was like, that's a pretty good, it's a sacrifice. Like, what do I spend time on? Hopefully it's like, oh yeah, I do spend 2 hours a night just watching reality TV. I guess I'll swap that out. Because otherwise,
that's an acceptable StarCraft swap.
Yeah. Quap swap.
I do have this job.
Quap does fit in the category of, you want to get good at Quap? All right, make your list.
Which you guys did.
Yep.
But I'll always have that. I'll always have that Quap facility. You know, that's something that'll stick.
That'll come back.
Yeah.
That'll pay dividends.
Every few months, I actually load up Quap just to make sure I've still got it.
Still got it?
Really?
Yeah, I do.
Well, is it like riding a bike?
It's not quite like riding a bike, but
what if they made
it's not at all like riding a bike.
No, but
what if they made a Quap that you had to like ride a bike?
No, 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 but I can still...
Think about it.
After a couple tries,
I can't tell if Chris is in the realm of satire here or
no. I'm being serious. Like, after a couple tries, I can get up to about 60 meters or so just after a few tries.
Do you get far enough that you can hear the music?
I remember talking about Quap is like, that,
what? I get up to 60 meters. You play until you start hearing the little tinkling of the Chariots of Fire song, and like, still got it, and
close
it down.
Like... Once I get to the point where I can get a few dozen meters, I'm like, all right, cool, I still got this. I'm like, I'm good for another few months.
With your schedule, Nate, do you play? Are you playing games much, or is it pretty much Dota and Softworks?
I wasn't playing games much around like Skyrim launch, but now I'm sort of catching up. Mm-hmm. Catching up, just playing old
Did you
games.
Guys just stop playing StarCraft? Because you were playing it a fuck ton for a while, and you got really good at it.
We just stopped.
Like, it was in sync. It wasn't just even one of those things where it was like, all right,
it was just one
enough.
Night, neither of us said, hey, you want to play StarCraft?
Yeah.
And we just never played it. We have not played it since.
That sounds like a lot of people's experience with like World of Warcraft or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, I was obsessed with it for years, and I was just like, nope,
yep,
and never touched it again.
Yep. Yep.
But I mean, I think in answer to that question, like, how do you get good at things? Well, like, you play with somebody who makes the learning process fun anyway.
Right, exactly.
Like, that's really the solution.
That was after the point where you'd moved to this side of the country, and so we didn't live in proximity to each other anymore. Well, that was actually when I was in Boston. So I was in Boston, and you were in Maryland.
Yeah.
And so that was really, like, for that period of time, that was a pretty big part of how we stayed in contact. Was just, we would,
well, and you guys were in the same time zone and everything.
Yeah, same time zone. We had voice chat. And so it was actually, I mean, it was really fun, even though we haven't done it in a while. But that was actually really, I enjoyed that a great deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we got really good. I mean, we actually got way up there. We'd enter long stretches of time where we would just be sitting at number one in our league for ages. Or we'd be at the very bottom and end up in some weird, like,
nether realm where the math
just would not allow us to get, no matter what. But it was a good experience of actually feeling like I was getting better at something, even if it's a worthless thing, and also just hanging out with a friend on the internet.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't a lot of things there aren't a lot of activities that, well, I guess on some level, that people, that's true of, you know, like I'm thinking of like,
well, especially purely recreational.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking like when you're like, if you're a kid and you hang out with your friends and you like skateboard while you hang out, it's like, oh yeah, now we can do way more sweet skate tricks. Yeah. And also we hung out, you know, like, which is interesting because in a lot of cases you hang out with somebody, it's just like, yep, we went to a bar.
Right.
We talked and then we went home, you know, and that's obviously that's good, but.
I was gonna be mean, but I'm not.
Or you hang out with your friends and talk, and then you get podcast that makes hundreds of thousands of dollars.
No, I was just going to self-awarely say that it's amusing that your adult example is two people sitting at PCs controlling science fiction alien armies in epic battle. It's cool.
But there is a dearth of things like that you can hang out and get better at something. I mean, you know, other than like, there's sort of like hobby sport communities of like people all go to the same rock climbing gym or like yoga or
you can go
like
golfing
this.
Together or whatever, but yeah.
Yep.
Or you can, you know, call your friend a lich.
Lich ought to have my mana.
Hey, lich.
If Nick starts calling me lich at the office, that's the line. That's when I'm out of Dota.
The usage of lich as a name rather than as a noun, rather than saying a lich, like
it took
the fact
you
that
a while
just,
for you to get your head around
it.
That.
Really
like,
did.
So what's his name? Lich. I understand he's a lich.
There are a lot of heroes like that. There's drow. What's the other one? That
there is just wizard and guy, like right, like not guy.
It's also just wizard and guy.
wizard and guy.
Wizard
and guy.
I mean,
alternately, wizard and guy.
That was my first.
Yeah, and is it actually an I short for ing?
Right.
But creatively, that game has, it feels like the creative content of Dota, they decided to just say fuck it and not put up any sort of rules for how they're going to name people, the tone in which that character is going to be presented. Some guys are just hardcore, like, bloody monsters, and other people are jokey idiots, like, from a Saturday morning cartoon. They just
Well, that's something I really associate with modern era Blizzard, which that game is directly evolved from.
Yeah,
it's true. You know, it's actually something that I don't like about World of Warcraft is... It's just how completely all over the place
it's
and totally
schizophrenic.
Yeah,
I was basically just Shrek.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's exactly correct.
But it's weird.
Well, what's weird about it is that they don't always translate. I mean, like, there's a huge demon guy, but he can just be like, you know, complete garbage. Like, you know,
you'd expect like, a huge demon guy to be.
I mean, it's to an extent. Then, like, I mean, they don't represent anything about what they actually are. I mean, they're just. It's just an avatar.
Yeah, well, games have that problem all over the place. You know, like, you'll be playing a fucking, I don't know if this is still true, but I suspect it is, Final Fantasy game where some guy has some attack where it's just, he fucking leaps into the air 10 times, has 14 javelins that he stabs into the other guy's eye, and then it's like,
miss.
14 points of damage. And the guy just boop, boop, boop. It's just, you know, that shit's just all over the place in video games. It's absurd.
Is it?
Nope.
Oh.
I agree with Chris.
Okay. Anyway,
I'm also playing Super Black Bass on a Super NES.
What?
You've been wanting to talk about Super Black Bass for multiple episodes.
Maybe I'll hold it back. Gosh,
what happened, Nick?
Huh? I just remembered I'm replaying Super Metroid right now.
I'm also playing Super Metroid.
Really?
Yeah.
And Sean's playing Super Black Bass. First, I want to talk about Super Black Bass for a second. Because
you had a great observation, which I always thought was incredibly
Wow, I don't remember what that was.
You don't? I was just excited by
the fact that it had Mode 7 graphics.
It does have Mode 7.
Yeah, when you cast the lure, it's this actual like first person lure cam where the Mode 7 like goes. Yeah. Up into the lake. It's awesome. That's really awesome. Nice. It's really good use of mode 7. The seventh mode.
For a fishing game.
When I was in like whenever that game came out, I was in like the second grade, and my dad's really like a sportsman, outdoors guy, and therefore all my buddies, our dads knew each other, or they worked together, so they were all the same type of guy. So eventually somebody was purchased Super Black Bass as a present because we'd have to go fishing with our dads. And I actually grew up and loved to fish and still fish. Anyway, we all became obsessed with the game because catching a fish is really hard in the game, especially when you're 8. So it was a triumph. I remember this kid, Scotty, called me. I caught a fish! Because we would play this game for hours and not be able to catch fish. And I probably put 40, 50 hours into the game. And then I've now, with my adult brain, realized that each lake is actually just a level and there's probably 10 lakes, but I never got past the second lake. So now with my adult faculties, I'm incredibly excited to see how deep this game goes.
Yeah.
So I sit down to play Super Black Bass and I realize that it's just been sitting on our Mac Mini for 6 months. And I'm playing for a while. And I look over at Jake, who's just really inspecting the UI and sort of the execution of the game. And I can't remember exactly the sentence you said, but it was like, somebody really cared about this game. And it's true. It's a really well-crafted game.
Sure.
Like, just from a... Like, there's... They didn't... It doesn't feel like a lot of corners were cut.
Well, also, it's a Super Nintendo game, so it's kind of on the cusp of this, but it is... It's got the weird, like... When DOS was not the only operating system you could end up having running on your computer, and people made weird simulation games, Super Black Bass, it's an SNES game, but it is like, all right, now I'm in the lake mode where I'm steering my boat around. Okay, now I'm in the part where the guy swings the reel back and forth. It's just a completely different screen, completely different art, completely different UI treatment, completely different controls. Okay, now the lure is flying into the lake, also completely different. Okay, now we've cut to the camera where the lure is sitting in the lake, and it's like, what is this? Like... No one makes anything like that anymore. It's really hilarious. Yeah, there's six modes, but it is just you throw a string with a thing onto it into the water, and then a fish bites it. But it is just like
it's Major Havoc. Did you ever play that?
No,
Major Havoc is really cool.
Major Havoc is crazy. Like it's a vector based.
It's like 1981.
Yeah, it's really early, and it starts off when you're in space and you're shooting asteroids and stuff, right? And
then it's sort of a little bit reminiscent of like Tempest. You don't go around in a circle, but it's perspective like that, and asteroids are coming towards you.
And then if you successfully complete that mode, it seamlessly goes into this sequence where you have to land the craft on a base, but because it's vector, your ship just smoothly transitions from
between
tweens right into from this perspective mode into a straight ahead 2D
like a side
view,
yeah.
and then you land on the thing,
and it's kind of like a moon lander. You land
exactly
on the platform.
Like a sort of inertia based landing thing, and then your guy jumps out,
and it
this
zooms
is all
in,
seamless,
and it zooms in further because now it's like man scale instead of spaceship scale,
and it zooms into your guy, and then your guy is in this base, and then it's just sort of a 2D side-scrolling platformer thing inside this base where you're running around with a guy. And all of this stuff, there's never any cut. There's
it's like you go into the base and you have to like hit the self-destruct and come back out. And you come back out and you get back in the spaceship and then it just zooms out and goes back out into space completely seamlessly, no cut.
That's it's pretty really much the flow incredible. Of Super Black Bass.
Yeah, almost exactly.
When the guy goes into the spaceship.
Right, and you're shooting the asteroids and then they catch a bluegill.
Yeah, it's pretty... This bluegill is small for this lake. And
you're bummed. It's so
difficult. Yeah. That's something that is interesting, replaying or playing for the first time games from that, well, I guess more replaying, games that you played when you were that age.
Right.
And now you have the perspective to be like, oh, these are levels and there's gating where I have to hit this goal to get to the next level and stuff, which you had no context for when
you
were
just had no
eight.
Concept
you're like,
of.
This is fishing.
It was just a blind squirrel trying to find his, you know, you'd find a nut and then you'd go again.
Because I'll place it like I on Virtual Console for the Wii, I played like the original Legend of Zelda and Link to the Past and Super Metroid. And, like, the structure of it and the progression of it is super clear. It's like, okay, I do this to get to here, to get to this, to get... But
as a kid, you're like, I'm in a world, and I have to do something, and maybe it's the thing that
you're like, what is this?
Thing.
I guess I'll go over here now, you know? Yeah. And it's interesting, because I feel like, in a lot of cases, for games that weren't super linear, like, when I was growing up, I played, like... Super Mario Brothers and Super Mario 2 and, like, Contra and stuff. And it's like, okay, go to the right, you know?
Right,
like,
yeah. Walk a man in the direction that you read. Right.
Yeah, and so those, it's clear, like, okay, you go forward and then you finish the game. But other stuff that's more open, I just remember playing it and not making any progress.
Right.
You're just I just go around.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Castlevania games are the exact same thing.
And it's like, maybe you do find a dungeon, and you're like, I guess there's a dungeon in here. You know, but you can't project far enough ahead to be like, oh, this is one dungeon of eight, so I need to go here, to go there, to go there, and then I'll finish the game.
Well, Super Metroid is mind-blowing in regards to that. Like, you'll just walk past dungeons that are just meant for like 5 hours down the line.
Yep.
And as a kid, you're just like, I know I was. I was like looking at that, like, how do I get to that?
Right,
how do I go through that glass that's just going to be broken with a bomb that I get 6 hours from now? Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, it's just playing it now is just I don't understand, like, how. But it actually works, like, because it, you know, you do backtrack, and then when you're backtracking, you see the thing, like, you know, you solve the puzzle that solves the other thing. I mean, actually, it's
Super
fairly
Metroid
coherent.
Genius.
I had never played Super Metroid as a kid. I played the original Metroid for a little bit, but I just couldn't get into it. I played Zelda and Mario to all hell, but playing Super Metroid now, that game is just destroying my brain, but not. Like, the structure of it is amazing. Like, obviously, you can tell what everyone rips off, but also, like, the art is amazingly good for a Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
And, like, the very beginning when you're escaping from the base and it starts just tipping. But the tone of it is also. It's the tone of it for a Nintendo first-party game for the Super Nintendo is ridiculous.
Yeah. Then, like, the music.
Almost Jesus Christ.
That whole
Nintendo first-party thing for any generation.
But it's
another time. I mean, Metroid Prime, I think, kind
of. You can put it as a contemporary, though, to Super Mario World and Link to the Past and then be like, Super Metroid. Like, the game just opens with a shattered science facility and two corpses on the ground.
That's one of the absolute best game introductions.
It definitely
ever.
Is.
I mean, ever.
Yeah.
It's
where it just
incredible.
Says Nintendo and
it's
then goes away. Metroid 3.
Too,
yeah, it's so good.
God, it's incredible.
There's a place pretty early on, right before one of the first major boss battles, where you finally sort of get into the weird organic sort of place where it's not just a rotted dead planet or a dead ship, but it starts having sort of weird bubbly creepy shit.
Yeah.
And there's some fangs and stuff and it's weird, but then you see this just sort of collection of pixels and you don't know what it is, and then you walk Samus close to it, and then it turns out that it's a bunch of bugs who then like all crawl out of the screen and then there's just the body of a previous bounty hunter there. And then like silent, passive, environmental storytelling of that caliber in a Super Nintendo game just crushed my brain. Like
Truly unbelievable.
I was playing an emulator, and I just went back and played through that again because it's like, what is this?
I didn't play that game when I was growing up either. For like, I had Super Nintendo. I just whatever. It's just you know, you can only buy so many games when you're a kid. And I did a full playthrough of it for the first time when I was working on BioShock 2, and like. Fucking blown away.
Yeah, you know, anybody like, here play that game when they were a kid on the Super NES?
I did.
Yeah. You did.
I think I pre-ordered it.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
See,
it wasn't even on my radar.
And at the time,
I don't think I knew Super Metroid existed even, because I was a huge Nintendo dork.
I definitely
right
knew
that time.
It did because I had a Nintendo Power subscription, but it was just like I never got around to it.
Yep.
You know? And having played it when I was 27 or something, I was like pissed that I didn't play it.
Yeah,
exactly. Like,
why didn't
I
have this?
What's funny is that I didn't. I mean, you know, as you guys know, I didn't have consoles growing up, so I played that game at an odd time, which is when I was in high school. That was really the first time I kind of made the conscious decision to like go back and play earlier console stuff that I just never experienced before.
Yeah.
And I played that game, and what's really almost like shameful when I think about it is that my experience playing Super Metroid that time, which was, you know, the first time I'd ever played it, was just totally bland. Like, I mean, it was great. It was awesome. I thought it was incredible, but just for purely mechanical reasons. Like, I engaged with that game on an entirely mechanical level.
Where you're like, sweet, I got a thing that shoots three lasers
now. Exactly. I was just, I was old.
Which is fucking sweet.
Right, no, I know. But I mean, I played enough games, like, even coming from a PC background, like, I played enough games to just intuit all of the structural elements of it in a way that, you know, a kid maybe wouldn't. But I wasn't really probably giving it like the, I don't know, emotional or just sort of atmospheric due that it deserved. I was just looking at it entirely as a mechanical experience and playing through it. And
you're looking at it kind of in a detached way.
Exactly. It was very detached. That's exactly correct. And also I was playing it at school, like in the computer lab. So it was not a good.
Well, I mean, that doesn't help.
Right, exactly. It wasn't a good environment. It wasn't a good environment to play it. But so then, that made it all the more.
Super NES in your computer lab?
No, it was just on an emulator.
Oh,
and so the
you pirated Super Metroid.
And so, you know, playing
a space pirate.
playing it later was like, oh man, nice. It was just all the more shocking to me, I guess, because I had played it sort of past the age where I had started thinking about games in a more critical way. Like, that was at the time I was playing games like Thief, which were, you know, I really actually spent a lot of time thinking about it in a more critical way. But that one, just for some reason, it didn't hit me in that one, in that particular...
But the second playthrough.
The second playthrough just fucking killed me. I couldn't even believe it. It was incredible. It was the same reaction all you guys described, right? It was just, I was noticing those little details left and right, and just, especially that introductory sequence, I remember just really hit me hard. Yep.
The whole beginning, just when the ship lands on the planet and then it's just raining and there's no music at all until you get like three levels deep.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Sorry. I mean, also, that's such a
bold choice. Yeah. There's no enemies, period?
We're talking about all the tone and aesthetics of that game, but also just structurally and mechanically, that game is out of control. Good work, Super Metroid. Good work, Nintendo. Whichever group that is.
Yeah.
I think Super Black Bass came out the same week as Super Metroid, so that's...
game was Super Black Bass?
Yeah, I was...
I thought you were saying, oh, so that's why Super Black Bass got overshadowed a little bit. You know, otherwise, it would be a classic.
Well, it's like, did you guys ever see the Mega 64 video about how Cabela comes out the same week as the new Halo game? And all the Cabela developers are just like, what the fuck is this? And they're calling up the GameStop and wondering why their game isn't getting the big stand-up. Sean was the guy. So like the one guy who went into the GameStop, do you guys have Super Black Bass?
It's like, hold on, let me look under these 4,000 copies.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me look under these already returned used copies of Super Metroid.
I appreciate the game mechanically so, like...
You talking about Super Black Bass?
Seriously, I don't have
No, it's to. Cool, do it.
The thing is about that game is it makes me want to bump into the lead programmer in an airport and just have a 20-hour
conversation. Well, because that guy would fucking die. Well, like, because you'd be like, dude, Super Black Bass?
I have your Super Black Bass t-shirt on. Yeah. You have the full, like...
That was a fun man.
If you had the brown vest that said Bassin on the back...
It does.
Your fisherman's got a brown vest.
We're talking about that. We're talking about if we could somehow figure out a way to license Super Black Bass through Idle Thumbs and then get the official Super Black
Make
Bass
the Bassin vest.
And just Bassin on the back. It's fucking cool. You would dig it, Steve. You'd really like it.
I am wearing a vest today.
If that said Bassin on the back and was brown, that would be it. So we could make that happen.
I'll work on
that. We could fold it inside out, it looks like. Anyway, the thing is you have like 12 lures that you can then expand to 25.
I said 12 lords.
Lures.
Yeah.
Lures. But, this isn't going to be good.
So here's the thing about Super Black Bass. You've got 12 lures.
There's some... Okay.
You have to go to a dungeon.
It's on a
day-night
cycle.
When I was a kid, I did not even fucking realize.
It sounds so dumb when I articulate it.
It's just one lure.
I feel like a stoned guy in a dorm trying to explain to people why this is good. But it's on a day-to-night cycle, and the fish care about what time of day it is.
And then a day-night cycle?
Yeah, dude, this is intense shit, man.
Super Black Bass.
It has a real time. You start, you only have this much time to catch fish. And they care what time it is, and if it's in the midday, the water gets warmer, and they go deeper. And then you have all these lures that either like are surface or deep water lures, but they only go to that level of water depending on how you're like manipulating them. So it's like speed in which you reel something in makes things dive up and down. And then you can... It's just like a really complex game, so you can figure out all the behaviors for all the things you have.
So it's an actual simulation. It's a legit simulation.
But it doesn't message any of these things.
But that's
which is
right.
Amazing.
That's what I was trying to say.
That's what simulation is all about.
It's a classic, crazy, supermodal sim game that you would probably actually play on your like Hercules graphics monitor PC. But it's on Super Nintendo. It's on the same platform that you play.
Well, stuff like that's really interesting when it pops up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost how I feel to some degree.
I feel like there's a lot of love in the game, is what I'm trying to say.
No, that's actually really cool. Yeah. I mean,
it's the thing that Brendan Chung cut out of Atom Zombie Smasher.
Well, it's got to be, it's got to be in the right game.
Yeah.
You know, like, Atom Zombie Smasher. Well, that game is already a demonically hard game. So I can see why, like, if that game was just the strategy element of it, I think it would be a different
story. Right, but if Atom Zombie Smasher had come out on the Super Nintendo, it probably would have still had all the crazy stat management.
Well, that's how I felt when I played Populous on the Super Nintendo. It was just like, it just made no sense to me that was on the Super Nintendo.
Dude,
and it was actually
hilarious. All of all of all Bullfrog's games from that era were on the Super Nintendo. I downloaded a ROM because I had no access to it at the time. This was like 10 years later, but I downloaded a ROM of Syndicate on the Super Nintendo.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's fucking weird.
Well, that shit is actually...
it's still isometric and you're still controlling a squad, but you're using a Super Nintendo.
It actually makes the systems harder for me to understand. Like,
that's exactly how I thought about they're filtered through that interface. All Axis games that did the exact same thing.
Right? Sim Life.
Yeah, I just remember thinking that Sim-branded games, because I only had a Super NES that could run anything, well, I always assumed that they were bad games because of the way they were, like...
It was incomprehensible.
Right. Well, except that Super Nintendo SimCity was good.
SNES SimCity was good, but all of
I was playing too much SimEarth.
All the other ones are insane.
Oh, Jesus, don't play SimEarth on a Super Nintendo.
I definitely rented that SimEarth.
That's what I was talking about. Yeah.
SimEarth
was
crazy. I didn't even know that was on console. I played that on the Mac.
SimEarth
Apple
was incomprehensible to me on PC, so...
That was the one... SimEarth was the one Maxis game I could never get.
What about SimLife?
What about Streets of SimCity?
That wasn't even an actual Maxis game, was it?
Well, you get to make a sweet muscle car and drive it around your city and shoot things.
Oh my god, I got that for Christmas one year and I was so excited for 20 minutes. And then
there's no actual
Pride.
Yeah,
Gay Pride SimCopter.
Yeah, what about that?
We talked about that on the podcast.
SimCopter.
What about Mega Race starring Lance Boyle? Come on, guys. Are you on top of this?
What are we doing?
We're taking a break. So we can drink some water and pee. Cut that part out, Chris.
We're taking a break?
It's an hour 24.
Yeah,
50.
Let's.
I think this might
let's take a break.
The break might last 2 days.
Yeah, we've been going for an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Although
this is the longest podcast we've recorded in probably well over a year.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think last year's GDC cast was.
I don't remember it being great.
But I mean, there's five people on it.
I remember that podcast really sucking, actually.
Sorry.
No, it wasn't because of you.
Jesus, fucking good thing we're ending
that
the podcast
it down.
Now.
I think
it wasn't.
It might be because of me. I was just really tired.
Well, it obviously wasn't because of me because I wasn't at GDC last year.
See?
There you go. We're cool, bro.
Oh, I see what's going on. This is over. I quit.
It was actually because of me.
Guys, I got a job in Maryland. I got to go.
But yeah, we're going to do more GDC stuff over the rest of the week.
Yeah, you guys are talking about maybe talking to some folks, and we'll just try and get anything we can get.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking to Nick Brecken for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, he'll be there.
He might, Nick Brecken might say something this week.
Yeah.
I'm Nick Brecken.
Oh, I'm Nick Brecken.
I'm
Nick Brecken.
I'm Nick Brecken.
I'm Nick Brecken.
I'm Nick Brecken.
We're Nick Brecken.
We're all Nick Brecken here. Nick Brecken.
Well, thanks for listening.
Thank you,
I'm
Steve.
I'm Nick Brecken.
Really, I'm Nick Brecken.
Okay.
No. Oh, are we
not? No, no, no.
No,
no,
no, but... No?
No, we need...
Oh, this
who's
part
this guy? I'm Nick Brecken.
There wasn't that. That was an hour 26:35.
Well, it's really an hour 15 since we did the game.
Probably 7 minutes of good stuff in there.
Yeah.
We've never had five of us. How did we go?
We did in the live show. Oh, no, but we didn't start with five of us.
Because it has to end with Nick.
Yeah, we're...
Does it?
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, we could just go clockwise. Just
start with Chris. Yeah,
it didn't end. It never ended with Nick.
I know, it did. It never was. It's a fucking lie. That's what's weird about it. If it was, I'm Richard Nick Brecken and I'm Jake Rodkin.
Right, no, but why
it's revisionist history.
But I'll tell you exactly where it comes from.
Yeah. Why?
This is where it comes from, because when you send in that tape.
Yeah, it's from your tape.
You went, and I'm Nick Brecken. And then I sat there and just said, and I'm Nick Brecken, like, 1,000 times.
Oh, shit, that's right.
That's where it came from.
Because you introduced yourself last on the live to tape Nick Brecken.
That's where it comes from. It's not just
also,
out of
the Also, aside from that, it's also, you are the person who is a reveal in this cast. Like,
right.
So we're going to put in the timpani roll for sure before.
I'm Nick Brecken.
I'm Nick Brecken. Anyway, welcome to GDC, whatever.
So how about we start with Chris and then go clockwise?
Oh, how about we start with Chris and go clockwise?
Did someone say that before?
Yes.
I did.
Fuck!
We should do a whole podcast where somebody suggests the last thing that somebody said.
Wait, you know what we should
do? We should do a whole podcast. That seems
to be... Whoa, that was crazy.
Oh.
That sounded like a crowd.
Oh, Jake Mazur's crazy sound effect. It sounds like zombies.
Lots of guys.
Anyway, you know what we should do? We should record this conf grenade.
I'm going home. I'm Nick Reagan.